Dreams are nothing more than wishes and wishes.
Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense. Welcome to the program. Not that anyone's asked me about movies of late, but if I was asked to make a list of the 10 worst films ever, I'm aware that's a completely subjective call, but if I was asked to draw up such a list, the 1998 romantic comedy You've Got Mail would definitely be in there. About the only good thing in the film was this. The Puppy Song by Harry Nilsson, which they used in the opening credits.
I turn on my computer. I go online.
Welcome.
And my breath catches in my chest until I hear three little words.
You got mail.
What is going on with you?
Is it infidelity if you're involved with someone on email?
This woman is the most adorable creature I've ever been in contact with.
Have you had sex?
You've Got Mail was truly awful. I know that's just my opinion, but it's true. And it starred Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan, and Email. Yes, Email. Which is probably the most interesting thing about the movie. As far as I'm aware, it was the first and last time that Email got top movie billing.
In a city where everyone's looking for someone, Joe and Kathleen have discovered the best way to meet someone.
Hi.
Is to never meet at all.
We just email. It's really nothing. I don't know his name or what he does.
Look. More than a decade and a half later, it seems odd that anyone would have made a film centred around Email, that they'd find Email sexy enough. In many ways, Email has been so successful as a means of communication that most of us now take it completely for granted. And you know, it's not cool to talk about email as a driver of 21st century communication. It's all social media these days. Search online and you'll find lots of stories declaring email dead and buried. I've got my PC open in front of me right now. And there's one here entitled The End of the Email Era. There's another, The Death of Email. And there's another here still headlined, Is Social Media the Death of Email? I could go on and on. But according to research conducted by the Radicati Group in the US, email has a very promising future indeed, despite being constantly written off. President and CEO Sarah Radicati estimates that in 2013 there were around 2.4 billion email users worldwide, as opposed to 1.4 billion Facebook users or Twitter, which had around 213 million active users. And according to Sarah Radicati, the indications for overall email usage over the next half decade are looking very healthy.
Still continuing to grow at a rate of about 6-7% a year in terms of volumes for business email. And that is because, in fact, it continues to be viewed in the business world as the serious form of electronic communication. And it's being flanked by other types of communication, such as social media, instant messaging, and a variety of things, you know, that are somewhere crosses between mobile and web-based tools and so on. Most of these newer tools have a couple of characteristics. They're either real-time or they are more intended for a sort of chatty, quick posting of short messages, you know, typically between friends or groups of friends. So that's where they end up really flanking email but not replacing it. Email continues to be the preferred electronic way to communicate what might be considered more serious business communications, which requires, you know, perhaps a longer explanation, which requires only certain people to see it and not everybody to randomly see it, and a variety of issues like that. So people, you know, when they sit down and they find that they need to communicate in the business context, you know, we'll rapidly make some decision about, okay, is this private? So in that case, it goes via email most likely. Or is this something that I want everybody in my organization to see, in which case maybe I'll post it on a social network.
You've got mail. The most obvious impact, and the one that really excited me when I first discovered email in the 1980s, was that I think it has, after several false promises, it has genuinely reduced the amount of paper that is being used for communication. And for those of us who like trees, that's certainly a good thing. Back as far as the 60s, people thought that computers were going to eliminate the use of paper, and in the medium term, they just increased the use of paper. But I think we've reached a point now where people are printing things out only as the exception rather than the rule. So that was the biggest thing that changed. Obviously, the speed of communication meant that a lot of things could happen faster, both in personal life, where people can trade insults a lot faster, or in business life, where people can reach deals a lot faster. So I think it's contributed substantially to the speeding up and the greening of our world.
Nathaniel Borenstein is an unabashed fan of email. And that's not surprising, given he helped make it what it is. You see, Dr. Borenstein created the first functional email attachment back in the early 1990s, and he's now the chief scientist for the email management company Mimecast. I should point out that Dr. Borenstein doesn't see a clear, rigid division between what we traditionally know as email and more recent examples of messaging and social media. He sees them all as being of the same broad family. But he does believe that while all forms of messaging will continue to innovate and change over time, the essentials of traditional email will survive, because email still has an advantage, he says, over other newer forms of communication, particularly where work and commerce are concerned.
There's a problem with modern social networking software that email doesn't have, which is that it's based on proprietary platforms. So Facebook users can only do most of the things they do with other Facebook users. Now, that's fine for a bunch of kids in school who all want to be in the same group, so once a few of them join Facebook, they all join Facebook. But a business can't tell its customers they have to join Facebook in order to communicate. The business wants to go where the customers are. So a ubiquitous medium like email makes a lot of sense. Now, there's no reason in principle that you couldn't have a ubiquitous framework for social networking. But the way it's evolved in the commercial internet era has not gone that way, and it probably won't go that way as long as there are a couple of dominant players who think that it's not in their interest to have such standards emerge. Meanwhile, on the business side, I think we're just in the very early stages of seeing what social networking can do. Social networking internally has as much potential value, I think, as it does personally, but there are problems that we're just beginning to overcome. You, in general, have much more concern about protecting information, and you have the cross-organizational issues. So you want to post something on your business social network, and you want it to be seen only by managers in your organization, or only by people working on a certain account, or only by people working on a certain account plus the customers at that account. So it has to cross the organizational boundaries and still be secure from other prying eyes. That's all possible, and there are a couple systems out there that are starting to provide that, but we're very early days on that.
Over the last couple of decades, we've seen predicted over and over again the death of email. Why do you think that is? Why have so many people been so willing to write it off over time?
Well, I think, first of all, people tend to be most hostile, if that's the right word, to things they're very familiar with. You know, sometimes in a marriage, you'll become more aware of your spouse's negatives than positives because you take the positives for granted. Email is in that space, I think. The positives are things we take for granted every day, and the negatives are things that we're much more aware of, like getting too much email. So when people complain about getting too much email, they think they're complaining about email, but in fact, they're complaining about getting too much information. In the pre-email days, they would have had a physical inbox overflowing with paper. And so when they imagine that by replacing email with something else, they're going to solve that problem, I think they're kidding themselves. Most of the proposals I've heard for, quote, replacing email, unquote, are actually proposals to build a different version of email that have some slightly different characteristics. And to my mind, that would just be part of the evolution of email. So even the people who are proposing to hasten the death of email, which I don't see coming, are generally proposing really just new forms of email.
And you're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today on the program, we're challenging the assumption that email is on the way out. As we've already heard, talk of its death has been greatly exaggerated. But if it is to remain a central communications force in coming decades, exactly how will it change?
I think email is one of those technologies that we don't really have a choice about whether or not we use. It's a bit like whether or not we need to drive to work in the morning being largely mandated by the city we live in. email was invented over 30 years ago, but it's used so broadly that I think it's safe to call it the world's default collaboration platform. It's the primary way that we communicate with one another, particularly if we're not already on intimate terms. But even then, sometimes we still do. It's the world's communication platform. And the people that do try and choose not to use email in a broad sense, that is, stop using it altogether, I think they almost invariably have to come back to it.
Software designer Gentry Underwood.
You know, you'll miss some very important invitation or that third message from a loved one or an old friend trying to get in touch with you and realize that the rest of the world didn't stop using email just because you did, and you're just simply missing out on messages that you might otherwise care about. So we have this kind of uncomfortable relationship with it where many of us feel overwhelmed by it. We get a lot of email from people we don't want to get it from. It's a burden on us to maintain our inboxes, but we can't really leave it either. In fact, really the only way we could stop using email is if we all kind of decided at the same time to use something else instead, and we all shifted to that new technology at the same time, which is a very, very difficult proposition.
But that's not to suggest that email isn't adapting, because there's big money, it seems, in trying to make email better. Last year, in 2013, Gentry Underwood sold the app he'd developed called Mailbox to the much larger file-sharing company Dropbox for a reported figure of $100 million. Now, try not to get lost here, because I need to explain that the reason Dropbox was interested in Mailbox was because of what Mailbox offers the average email user's inbox. Gentry Underwood.
So Mailbox is an email inbox that's redesigned for mobile. And one of the things that we know about how people use email on their phone is really they're interacting with their mail in a couple of minutes here and there while doing something else. And their primary goal is to make quick decisions about what they need to work on or pay attention to or respond to now, what they can put off until later, and what they never need to deal with again. What we've done with Mailbox is created an interface that really encourages that kind of behavior. You can swipe a message to the right if you never need to see it again to send it to an archive or push it onto the trash. Or you can swipe a message to the left and up pop a series of snoozes where you can put a message into a list of things that you need to deal with this weekend, and they'll come back into your inbox then, or maybe things you need to deal with after work or tomorrow. You can also push it off into a particular list of things like items you need to buy or articles you want to read. And so with these simple finger gestures, you can go through a pretty full inbox fairly quickly, making a lot of quick decisions about how you need to handle the messages and kind of bring your inbox under control.
Of course, we're not trying to give Gentry Underwood or any other technology developer a free plug. But his app, Mailbox, is a really good example of the way in which individuals and companies are thinking about the need to streamline and or value add to traditional email. And where Mailbox appears to have found a niche is in helping people to better access email from mobile devices. Gentry Underwood again.
When we began to realize how people were using mail on their phone and how much frustration and pain there was around email, in spite of the fact that we had computers more readily available, it seemed like people were even more frustrated about mail than in the past. I think we saw it as an opportunity to change that relationship, to create a tool that helped people put email in its place, help people give people a different kind of relationship to mail. We started from that observation of triage, of recognizing that the most important part of an email client on the mobile would be the ability to make those quick decisions and do it in as efficient way as possible. And then we blended that with a kind of a gestural interface that really takes advantage of these multi-touch screens. Rather than having little buttons that replicate what you might click on with a mouse, we tried to build something that was delightful to swipe through and made use of colors and gestures as really a lightweight, quick way for people to make decisions about their mail and just change the overall feel of the inbox.
So what was important in that realization was that you weren't really just looking at how to change technology, but you were looking at the way in which people's behavior had changed and the way in which you could modify the technology that already existed in the form of email to match those changing behavioral approaches. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're in this very funny era where you might think of a person carrying around a mobile phone as being a sort of computer-person hybrid. A long time ago, computers were these large room-sized devices that a person went to visit and spend time with. And then later on, we adapted to a personal computer that could sit at your desk. And after that, a personal computer that was networked and hooked to the internet. And what we've done with these mobile phones is taken that computer off of a desk and attached it to a person. We carry these things around in our pockets, and they're with us all the time. And that actually enables a whole set of new kinds of interactions that weren't really possible, and a whole set of different values or goals. It's one thing for me to sit in front of a computer and pull up an application and sort of step into its world. And if it's hard to use or frustrating or filled with buttons and a bit overwhelming, I'm a bit more tolerant of that because I'm just at the desk in front of the computer living in its environment. But these little guys, these phones, we carry them with us into our lives, and we're far less tolerant of inefficiencies and hard to use experiences and anything that kind of increases the chance that we get more distracted from the other things we're trying to do at the same time that we're using them. And so accordingly, the apps that are really working or winning in the marketplace are very simple ones that sit alongside our lives more conveniently and more in a more friendly way than apps have in the past.
Now, that seems obvious in one sense, but a lot of people involved in the development of our new technologies, they overlook that, don't they? They find that very difficult to realize. Why is that the case, do you think?
Designing simple solutions is always much, much more difficult than designing complicated ones. Whenever you set out to solve a problem, it seems simple at first, and you start down a path where you think you're going to solve it, but as you do, you begin to recognize that there's more and more complexity, more and more edge cases, more and more pieces of the problem that you hadn't considered. And most people stop there. That's what a lot of the software is that we're all used to. It's functional, but it's complicated. It takes a lot of iteration and a lot of pushing beyond that complexity to get to the sort of simplicity that lives on the other side, where you get to a design where people see it and they say, of course. That's a really nice experience to have as an end user, and as a product designer, you really hope that your user feels that way. But the process of getting there is anything but easy. It's a substantial amount of iteration with the kind of commitment to reaching that simplicity.
You've got mail. You've got mail. You've got mail. You've got mail. You've got mail.
Anything but easy. Well, they're words that certainly strike a chord with UK-based entrepreneur Rich Waldron. Like Gentry Underwood, Rich and his colleagues also came up with an app which promised to make email much more user-friendly. Theirs basically made a person's email account operate like a personal assistant. For the sake of this program, the specifics don't really matter. What's important is that after initial success, they've now abandoned the project. So why did it fail? And what does that failure tell us about the difficulty of trying to improve a well-established piece of technology like email? Rich Waldron.
Firstly, with the technology itself, we actually got that developed, and we were able to create high-level rules on your inbox. So we could connect into initially Gmail and Google accounts. You could then connect up with a few different web services, and you were able to actually create the rules that we set out to do in the first place. However, there's a couple of headaches with this. The first one being email is fundamentally free. Not many people necessarily pay to use their email. And in order to get somebody to consider paying for an add-on meant that finding a revenue stream or a business model in this was pretty tough. The second thing is there's a lot of trust around inbox, and people are naturally fairly wary of granting access to their email in order for you to use it in the first place. So when we kind of looked at where we were going to go with this and you know, if this was a company we were going to build, was this something that we were going to be able to come? Was this something that we were motivated to solve? Because you have to really care about digging in deep with your inbox in order to kind of get over these hurdles, especially when you look at something like, again, Google accounts, Microsoft Exchange. There's lots of different varieties of email where there are lots of pockets of people. And in order to be able to kind of get into these and then monetize on top of them would require a lot of work before you even got off the ground. And where this whole thing kind of links together is in order to do that, you really need to go and raise some investment. You need to be able to pick up some funding and say, look, this is what we want to do. This is how we're going to do it. We found that investors were naturally fairly cautious about investing in this space. Questions about, you know, how are you going to turn this into a $1 billion idea, or how are you going to be able to monetize this to, you know, fund your growth and actually get to the kind of enterprise size customers that you'd like to. What we've seen with email products that have been successful, I think Mailbox is a good example, the iOS app, they took a slightly different approach in that they were looking at how you handled email once you'd received it. So they built a really nice client for the iPhone. It kind of nips a lot of the issues that we had in the bud. And whilst they didn't monetize it per se, it meant that it was attractive enough for a big incumbent to come along and snap them up and make them part of their team in Dropbox.
So given all of that, it's not surprising then, is it, that there has been so little development, so little change to email over the last couple of decades.
It isn't surprising. I think a lot of people have set out to try and do it. And I think the big challenge is changing mentality of people that currently used to having a free product and saying, look, this is what we can do. And getting far enough along with your development to be able to show that you have something that's stable, that hasn't got any risks. As soon as you start messing around with people's email, you cannot have any mistakes. You can get away with it if you build a Salesforce, as an example, because if people can't access that, then they'll ring you up and they won't be too happy. But it's not going to disrupt them in the same way that if you have a problem with their inbox. If you were to lose emails, if they were to go into some kind of cycle, then you know naturally that could be the end of your company. And I think in order for there to be developments, there needs to be some fairly significant investment, either from a big company already that wants to set out and change focus and work on some of the email protocols themselves. There's lots of interesting ideas, such as expiring email is something that came up quite a lot. I went to a few conferences in San Francisco, and there's one called Inbox Love, which actually is an entire conference developed focused on people building email products. And there were loads of great ideas there and some really successful companies, but a lot of them were in the email marketing space rather than focusing on how can we help consumers and business workers with handling and triaging their email.
Rich Waldron, CEO of the company Tray. Our final guest today is Caroline Webb. We've had her on the program before, talking about how people deal with information overload. She's now the chief executive of the management and leadership consultancy Sevenshift. Caroline has done quite a lot of work looking at the ways in which businesses and their workers communicate. And she too sees email remaining the backbone of our communication well into the future. But what's interesting though, is that she started to notice shifts in the way many people use email because of the influence of social media. Email, it seems, is starting to loosen its tie.
The norms that surround instant messaging and Facebook and Twitter are definitely quite different to the old norms of email, because email was initially a sort of replacement for letters. And so most people started off by being quite formal in the way that they wrote their emails, with dear so-and-so at the top and then best wishes, best regards, kind regards, and a lot of effort spent on getting the exact right sign-off. And that's still the case for many people who are using email. But as people have become more familiar with other social media platforms, you have seen a lot more people starting to adopt some of the norms of those shorter communication forms. And that can cause a bit of a problem, because you can get two people who are exchanging emails and one feels that the other is extremely verbose and the other feels that the other is extremely terse. And you can feel that there's some kind of rudeness or mismatch in style when it's not really reflecting any true difference in people's views or opinions. So I think I tend to see a real benefit now in being very clear with people what your email etiquette is. And one of the things that I've seen work very well is this new movement to keep your emails to 3 sentences or 4 sentences or 5 sentences, but be very explicit about it. There's a colleague that I know who adopted this quite early on, and his emails at the bottom say, click on this link to find out why this email is 5 sentences or less. So I'm very clear that he's signed up to this attempt to keep emails as tight as you see on some other social message platforms, but I'm not offended by his briskness. And I think also I've noticed that there are plenty of people who are getting better at writing short emails without taking the warmth out. I don't think brevity has to mean cold, and I think being attentive to how you can convey warmth as well as being brief, that's the sweet spot.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we often look at a platform like email and we think about change related to that platform as technological change. We don't often think about the social change that goes on over time, the ways in which we actually use it, as opposed to the ways in which we are technically able to use it.
I think all technology has a social component and is essentially a behaviour. I mean, of course, there are some technologies that are so transformative that you can't help but shift your behaviour when you're using it. But by and large, I think that most technology can be neutral. It's a question of what we then do with it and integrating it into our social lives. And absolutely, I think that one of the biggest things that needs to shift is a new etiquette around email, and that is very social. That is, in some ways, it feels very old-fashioned. The idea of even using the word etiquette, it conveys something which comes from a prior era. But definitely we need to think harder about how we set expected response times, for example. We all feel terribly overwhelmed by the amount of email, and certainly the solution for some people has been to say, well, I just simply can't respond to all the email and I'm just too busy. But if it's an email that's been sent to you as opposed to simply CC, that creates a great deal of uncertainty in the sender. And we know that uncertainty is processed by people's brains as a threat. And we know that when people feel under threat, they think less well. And we know that social exclusion has a similar effect on people. And so if you've sent an email to someone and they're not responding, you don't know why they're not responding, and it makes you feel bad. And although the person who's not responding is doing it for, you know, perfectly reasonable reasons in their own mind, the effect on the relationship can be pretty bad. So being smarter about how you get back to someone without it taking too much of your time is a skill that we're going to have to develop, I think, more and more. And there are many things that work. One is to send a quick one-line acknowledgement that doesn't get into detail but indicates that you've received the email, you're glad it's there and you're going to get to it. Or you set an autoresponder that tells people when to expect a reply, which may not be imminent, but at least, again, they feel acknowledged and heard. You can also program autocorrect text, which allows you to type in one word or just a few letters as an acronym, and then it spews out a whole email that can be a sort of standard email response to certain situations. All of these things are rarely used at the moment, but if they were used, then a lot of people would be sitting around feeling more recognised and more heard for their unanswered emails.
Caroline Webb, Chief Executive of the management and leadership consultancy Seven Shift, ending our look at email today. Also on today's program, we heard from the CEO of Tray, Rich Waldron, Gentry Underwood from Mailbox, email pioneer Nathaniel Borenstein from Mimecast, and Sarah Radicati from the Radicati Group. Remember, you'll find a transcript of today's show on our website, and you can also stream or download the audio and listen to it again. And by the way, this year, Future Tense can also be heard on RN every Thursday at 2:30. So if you like to listen via the radio rather than as a podcast, you can always catch us again on Thursdays if for some reason Sunday doesn't suit. Next week on the show, we'll speak with Jose Gomez Marquez, a medical device designer from the Little Devices Lab at MIT in the States. We'll talk about 19th century viral media with Ryan Cordell from the Infectious Text Project at Northeastern University, also in the US. And we'll be joined by this man.
My name is Rich Pell, and I'm the director of the Center for Postnatural History in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we're a small museum that's dedicated to living things that have been intentionally shaped by human culture. So everything from the dawn of domesticated plants and animals, all the way through to selective breeding, genetic engineering, and synthetic biology. And we look at these organisms as kind of cultural works, the same way you might look at the architecture of a civilization. And we ask ourselves, how does it represent the values of the people who've created them?
Rich Pell and the Center for Postnatural History. That's next week. Thanks to co-producer Andrew Davies and sound engineer Peter McMurray. I'm Anthony Fennell. Bye and take care.
Does your religious belief or lack of it determine your vote? A new analysis of trends in Britain confirms some things we suspected, but some big surprises as well. Religious conservatives are more pro-welfare than their atheist compatriots. And what do the results of our last election reveal about how our faith groups vote? Download or podcast these fascinating revelations on the Religion and Ethics Report at the RN website.